Hearing this text this morning, there are probably two reactions. One is you shut out right away and said, that's it. Don't want to hear anything about it because the Bible is so outdated. Has nothing to say about really relationships, how they work with women and men today. Others would say and sit here and say, hey, preacher brother, tell them, you know, they need to hear it again, what their role is, and I mean our wives. And certainly those two extremes are not helpful at all when it comes to texts like this and looking at those Bible texts. In some ways, what often is the tendency when we read the Bible and come to those texts that we make them or try to make them as palatable as possible to the tastes of our time. And that's not my intent today. I just really want to take an honest look at this text and see what does it say for our life today. How can we draw some things out of this text that are helpful for our relationships in our families and beyond? It's unfortunate that this kind of text has often been used as the legitimate to legitimize domestic abuse. It's in so many ways that those words were twisted and turned to make the husband the lord of the marriage and of the wife. And we thought oftentimes, even reading those texts, that this also gives us license to beat up our women, control them, and treat them as inferior to us, human beings, or male human beings. This is not our topic this morning, domestic violence, but I would say domestic violence and abuse is unfortunately one of the most guarded secrets in Christian circles. Unfortunately so. When those roles are misunderstood and misused. This has never been the intent of this text. It has never been the intent of the Bible. And in fact, there is actually never, ever a biblically justifiable reason for using violence in marriage. Never. There's never a biblical justifiable reason for one controlling another, whatever form of control we may exercise. This said, what does this text tell us this morning? What do we take out of this? So we mentioned several times that this comes out of the letter that Peter writes to a church that was somewhere in northern, what would be now Turkey, where they were gathering in houses, potentially. They didn't have churches at those times. They just met in houses, and those who were Christians gathered together to encourage one another and have some form of worship in order to do what God has told them to do. And Peter is writing those young Christians and give them some instructions how to live out their faith in Jesus Christ in this world. Last week we looked already at how he described the whole idea of how to live as a citizen in our country. In the country then, and how we can apply this to our country today. And here he reminds us how we can live as Christians in families, in our family relationships. Now, it's certainly clear that family looked different in those days than today. We always have to be aware of this when we look at those texts. But it's also important to know this because sometimes we then simply draw wrong conclusions out of this. A sociologist, and I mentioned him here and there, who has been very influential in looking into the reasons why Christianity has been spreading so rapidly in the first 300 years, dedicated an entire chapter in one of his books to the role of women. It's the book, if you ever want to read it, worthwhile reading, The Triumph of Christianity by Rodney Stark. And he writes in this chapter the following. He says, the rise of Christianity depended on women. In response to the special appeal that the faith had to women, the early church drew substantially more female than male converts. And this in a world where women were in short supply. Having an access of women gave the church a remarkable advantage because it resulted in disproportionate Christian fertility and in a considerable number of secondary conversions. Here's the background. In the Roman society, to be born as a girl was right from the start a disadvantage. You were considered a shame if you were born into a family and you were considered to be expensive. Not because you were wearing fancy clothes or any of this stuff, but expensive in terms of you were just an expense because you could not contribute to the household income like a male would do. In a society where women had no public life, they would not share in public life outside of their house. If so, then very limited. All public life was managed by males. And what happened is that the practice was becoming very common that if you were born as a girl and you were the firstborn and the first girl, they might have kept you. If you were born as the second girl into a household, it was very common to take you and just leave you unattended outside somewhere in the fields. And guess what? And you died. And that was very common, that girls were just thrown out of the house, left outside in the fields, and died. It led to the point that there was a shortage of women. That's what it does, this kind of practice. And when it comes to marriage, it became a problem. Because who do you marry if there is a shortage of women? It was against the times that we have today. There were more men or more male than women in those days. However, what's also interesting is that in these early years that Christians did not participate in this practice. Christian households and Christian families, according to what they got to know about God and what God taught them, they valued female and male. And that led to the simple fact that there were more Christian women at some point of time than non-Christian women, pagan women. And that also led to the point that there were a lot of mixed marriages. And because what does a pagan or a Gentile male who wants to marry, what is he supposed to do? And not that those marriages were free choice, as we know, they were also arranged. So there were only one thing, that you married a Christian girl. So there were a lot of mixed marriages in those days, where the female was Christian and the male was non-Christian, because there was no choice. This, by the way, is not a license to marry whoever you want. I still think it's good and prudent to think about who you marry. And that would be helpful if those ones or the spouse that you marry will be a Christian, a follower of Jesus Christ. It makes things way simpler. Not that it's easier. Not that it's always guaranteed that's a good marriage, but it takes some problems away, just as a side note. But this is the background of this text. So there were many women in non-Christian households who had no rights, who could not argue with the husbands because they had no voice, they had no opinion, they were weak, they were of no value. How do you live as a follower of Jesus Christ? And this is where this text comes in. This kind of environment was the text in which early Christians had to live and thrive and survive. And therefore, it's always good if we read texts like this that we do not take them point blank and say, this is how it has to be for all times and all generations. And many have done so, unfortunately, with many of those texts. And has gotten created a lot of trouble with that in the meantime. So let me suggest that there's a couple of things that we can learn from this text that help us to appreciate what Peter is telling us. What is it? I would say what Peter wants us to show is that if we honor God in our relationships, it has benefits. If we honor God in our relationships, it has benefits. And he names several of them in these texts, in these verses, that give us even a clue for how we can apply this today. So the first that he will give us is if you honor God in your relationships, if you just do what he called you to do, the first thing you gain is influence. Is gaining influence. Well, influence in itself is something we have to think about. Influence is not manipulation. If we talk about influence, then it's not that I make it a project to influence someone. Because exactly in that moment, it becomes manipulation. If I make it a project to influence someone, I manipulate. Because I just act in order to see certain results. Influence is just simply happening, mostly without the knowledge of the one who is the influencer. Because of the way he or she lives, or what he or she does. It just simply leaves an impression on other people. So when we talk about influence here, we talk about this kind of attitude. Not this kind of deliberate looking at, oh, how can I influence my husband in this context? But rather, how can I live in a way that honors my God and leave the results up to him? So here's where the first few verses of this text come in. Peter writes here, the same now, and I read from the message. It's good to sometimes read it from different translations. He says, the same goes for your wives. Be good wives to your husbands, responsive to their needs. There are husbands who, indifferent as they are to any words about God, will be captivated by your life of holy beauty. See, the point that Peter makes is, you want to win people for Jesus Christ. You want to tell them something about who you are and who Christ is for you. And he says, and just lives in such a way. And don't worry about the results. He says, even in the fact that by the way you live, you will influence the people that live with you. Again, to quote Rodney Stark, he writes, secondary conversions of husbands were very common in early Christianity. And the major reason was the great prevalence of mixed marriage due to the great surplus of Christian women in a world suffering from a considerable scarcity of pagan brides. Many Christian girls had to marry pagan men or remain single. And for many pagan men, it was either a Christian bride or bachelorhood. So here talks about this, that many men were won through secondary conversion. And what he means by that, they were not directly exposed to a message or a sermon or a service, but they lived together with Christian wives. And it says, Rodney says and makes the point that Christianity grew among them because many of those women lived such a life that they influenced their husbands so that they became Christians as well. He even attributes the growth of Christianity in the first 300 years to this fact as one of the main factors of that. So the text challenges us, first of all, how can I influence people that live around me and my family so that they can see Jesus Christ? We all live in different family environments. And family is this kind of environment where we have to let down our masks. That's where the spouse sees us for exactly who we are. Whether we have slept well or not, whether we are in good mood or bad, and whether we flip out, and whether we have anger issues, and whether we have all kinds of other issues. Here in the family, we are an open book. And there's no place like a family where we are also on display, where our character is on display. And Peter makes the point, is this is also the place where through your life you can show others who Jesus is. And in this context, especially those in your family that do not follow Jesus Christ. See, the arguments don't lead to faith in Jesus Christ. Manipulation doesn't lead to faith in Jesus Christ. As much as we often want it. Oh, please come here, you know, and I pray for you. And finally, when will you finally give your life to Jesus? Please. This is manipulation, but it will, if it does anything, it turns them away. But if there's one thing we can do is just live our lives as followers of Jesus Christ, fully devoted, fully obedient to Jesus Christ, and say, God, I want to do what you called me to do. I want to live before you. And you can take what I have, do with it what you want. Live your life as a Christian. By the way, it's one of the things that I find in many ways of counseling with couples and in my own experience. The greatest challenge almost in every marriage is my character. And the best advice I can give is work on your character. Work on yourself. And don't try to manipulate the other person. Work on yourself. Work on your character. Become more like Christ. And let Him shine through you, that we become those mirrors. Remember those mirrors that we used to have as kids? You know, there was those great discoveries. And you can take a little mirror, take the sun, and reflect the sun so that you blind other people, you know, and just have those little games. But that's what we need to do for Christ. We reflect Christ, not to blind people, but to show them who He is. That we become those mirrors. And that we work on our character. So that would be the first advantage. The second one is appreciation. It's a benefit of a God-honoring relationship that we receive appreciation. See, that's what we all need. We all need appreciation. We are born that way. And if you feel like you don't need it, then you are either an emotional cripple or something is really wrong in your emotional balance. We need appreciation. And it's so evident even when you raise children, how that is so evident in children. You know, when they're tiny children and they go down the slide for the very first time, what do they do? Hey, daddy, daddy, look at me. And juice, they go down. They want attention. And they want appreciation. And we do well as parents to give it to them because they need it. They need it. They need this affirmation and appreciation from our side as parents. And if you don't give it to them, we have all the ramifications of that will later on to lead to some ways where they look for appreciation somewhere else. If they don't get it at home. So we need appreciation, but the problem is we need appreciation from the proper sources. And it's always wrong to manipulate others into appreciating me. We are also good at that sometimes. When we do certain things a certain way so that as much attention as possible so that people would say, oh, well done, great job. But that never tastes good, does it? It never really tastes good. But appreciation comes out of free will. This is awesome. If somebody out of the blue, you know, says, well, I really appreciated that. And that's what we need to seek. In this text, Peter expresses it this way. He says in verse 3, what matters is not your outer appearance, the styling of your hair, the jewelry that you wear, the cut of your clothes, but your inner disposition. Cultivate inner beauty, the gentle, gracious kind that God delights in. So he talks about attention seeking. He talks about appreciation. And he says, nothing against, and many circles have that read into that, oh, women are not wearing clothes, do not wear fancy clothes or jewelry and all this kind of stuff. So please, this is not what the text says. But it says something about where to seek attention from. Who do you want to impress? Before whom do you live? And the most important person that a follower of Jesus Christ lives is before God. I live my life before God. He is my God. I seek His attention. And He says, if you work on your character, you will get the attention. He said, this is something God delights in. He says, by your inner disposition, cultivate inner beauty, a gentle, gracious kind of spirit that God delights in. That's a lifelong project. To create this kind of inner spirit. To become more and more like Him. Friends, we talk about discipleship here. Do you notice that? We talk about following Jesus Christ. And following Jesus Christ means to follow Him because I want to be like Him. I want to learn how to be like Him. How that I can display His character. That means I work on my character. And we call this holiness or sanctification, or name it whatever you want to name it. But this is what we are talking about. And if this is not happening, something is wrong. But if it's happening, if we are focusing on that to become more like Him, we get all that we want. And in this case, we get appreciation, that the Father in heaven appreciates me and He looks at me favorably. And here I find it in a way that God, that nobody else can give it to me. Anything, any other appreciation is very temporary. No, it's very temporary because it can twist in a moment. You know, that's not really reliable. The only reliable appreciation we get is from God. Thirdly, the next benefit is prestige. That's one of the things we often look for also in our life, prestige or status. Just look at what the clothes that you wear, the car that you drive, the house that you live in. How much of that is because of certain status? Not that it's always like that, but often a reflection of that. You know that I represent certain things. And status is in itself, again, nothing wrong in itself. The question is only, what kind of status are you seeking? And for what reason? To impress others? To feel like better than anyone else? Wrong reason. Well, let's see what Peter has to say here in this context and how that expresses itself. He says in verse 5 and 6, the holy women of old were beautiful before God that way, and were good, loyal wives to their husbands. Sarah, for instance, taking care of Abraham, would address him as, my dear husband, you will be daughters of Sarah if you do the same unanxious and unintimidated. So the lesson of this text is not that you women now need to say to your husbands, my dear husband, because that's what Sarah did. That's not the point. The point is that we want to be in a certain league of people. We want to belong to a certain club. And Peter says it would be great if you belong to the club of Sarah. Sarah was not just any woman. She was the wife of Abraham. Abraham, as we know, was the one with whom God started new humanity. It was the one with God, with whom God started all over again. And as usual, with every great leader, there is a great spouse. And that was Sarah. And here in this context, she's mentioned as such, a great lady. Not perfect, as we know the story, but nevertheless great, supportive. And what was characteristic of Sarah is not her submissiveness, but, and the message is translated actually very interesting, her characteristic was that she did good things, unanxious and unintimidated. It's not about crawling on the floor and being your foot mat, you know, and whatever. She did the right thing. And that's what the text says. She did the right thing, unanxious, unintimidated. She stood for what she stood for. Before Abraham and with Abraham. And that's the place where we want to belong to. We want to do the right thing, what God calls us to do, without anxiety and without intimidation. Nobody should intimidate us to do what is right. And how many times are we put into this corner where we are just intimidated by role and function and title and who knows where, you know, and we just submit. They said, no, do the right thing. And that's what he says with Sarah. Sarah stood up to Abraham. She honored him, supported him, But she was unanxious and unintimidated, standing there right by his side. She was not fearful. She did what was right in her relationship with Abraham. And that's what we are called to do the same thing. Stand by your family members. Unanxious, unintimidated. Do what is right. With your children, with your parents, with your spouses. Do what is right. Stand for the right things. And do the things in the proper way. That will earn us the proper privilege. The next qualification that we find here in this text is not just prestige, that's not prestige, but also privilege. And that's another thing that we often seek in, is privilege. You know, to know somebody. You know, how good it is if you don't have to stand in line because you know the person that you want to see and you just have a, you know, way in there. And, oh, good to know you. Great, don't have to wait in line, you know. Prestige or privilege. You know, if you don't do what everybody else has to do because you have their certain knowledge and your certain connections and all this. We like that. Come on. You know, we all like to do that and brag about it, who we know and whatever. But again, it can also be done for all the wrong reasons and all the wrong places. Privilege, on the other hand, is something that is given to us without being earned. And Peter talks about this in a very different context. And listen very carefully. He turns his attention now to men. And he says, the same goes for you, husbands. Be good husbands to your wife. Honor them, delight in them. As women, they lack some of your advantages, but in the new life of God's grace, you are equals. Treat your wife then as equals, so your prayers don't run aground. Now, how is this text about privilege? It is about the privilege of entering into the presence of God in prayer. And this text tells us something, that this privilege can be taken from us. And it can be taken from us if in our family we are not living the way God is honored. And in this particular text, he talks about husbands. Not all of your prayers are automatically answered. And that may have to do how you live in your marriage. And I cannot emphasize this enough, how important it is to God that you live a God-honoring marriage. Because if you don't, He will not listen to your prayers. And I would sometimes want to stop you and go home and think about it. Look at your relationship. Why is this so important? If, for example, there is a very domineering or even abusive relationship, how do you think prayer looks like? Prayer then is contrived. Prayer is coerced. Prayer is forced into. And you never feel like comfortable praying because your relationship is not right. Can I ask you a very simple question? How does it feel for you to pray with your spouse? How does it feel? Do you pray with your spouse? And if you do, how does it feel? And I don't mean that it could be awkward and all this stuff, I know. But if your relationship is not right, prayer is not right. And you can tell me what you want. This is what you will feel. If your relationship is not right, your prayer is not right. And this is exactly what he says. Don't mess up your privilege. Your privilege is that you can come as a couple together before the presence of God. And it has to do how you relate to your spouse. How your prayers are answered. Lots to think about. How can I live in such a way with my spouse that my prayers are answered? And he tells husbands here, they are, by the way, your equals. Yes, they may have disadvantages because they are made not physically as strong as you are, and that was very dominant in those societies in those days. That's why women were not counted as much, because they were not physically strong. But we know nowadays that this is not the only strength that we need. There's many other strengths that we need that women have. But in this kind of environment, that didn't count. So he says, but anyhow, that's his point, you're equal. God is not putting one up and the other one a little bit lower than that. God says you're equal. And the New Testament text, we don't have time this morning to go through each one of them, but this is highlighted, that this is true. You can come before God as equal partners. Your spouse has the same right to stand before God as you do, no matter whether male or female. And then next, another benefit is blessing. Simple blessings. Do you want to be blessed? Blessing is good things. Blessing is standing under a shower that showers good things over us. Do you want to have that? He says, live in the right relationships. It's what he says. Verse 8. Summing up, be agreeable, be sympathetic, be loving, be compassionate, be humble. That goes for all of you. No exceptions. No retaliation. No sharp-tongued sarcasm. Instead, bless. That's your job, to bless. And you will be a blessing. And also get a blessing. See, that's the secret. Here he sums it all up. If you want to know what does it look like to relate to one another properly, here he says, gives you some points, what you need to do. You know, be agreeable, sympathetic, loving, compassionate, humble, no retaliation, no sharp-tongued sarcasm. Bless. Start blessing your spouse. Start blessing your children. Start blessing your parents. Bless them. And blessing in itself means actually only speaking good. So start with that. Start speaking good things about your parents, about your wife, about your spouse. Speak good things. And he says, and you receive blessing. And then he moves on and quotes Psalm 34. And he says, whoever wants to embrace life and see the days filled up with good, here's what you need to do. Say nothing evil or hurtful. Snub evil and cultivate good. Run after peace for all your worth. Good God looks on all with this with approval, listening and responding well to what he asks. But he turns his back to all those who do evil things. I would sometimes say, even in marital counseling, just do that. Just do that. Stop talking about each other. Stop talking mean way about one another. Just don't be hurtful to one another. I mean, it would be so simple. But it is simple. It is this kind of principles that describe a God-honoring relationship. When we simply apply this kind of words. And again, the family is the training ground. Because here, we can all do this very easily. We are nice people. We all nice. We just say hi to one another, you know, and greet one another, hug one another, and whatever. And it's great to see you. Wonderful. We can be so supportive. And then we step out of the doors, and we go into the car, and the world changes. But that's exactly where we need to be the same, and go there too, and do the same thing with one another. And that's where we practice that. That's where we then also, what God says, receive blessing. God honoring relationships pays dividends. It pays dividends. It will give us influence. It will give us status. It will give us privilege. It will give us appreciation from God. So let's start working on it. To practice this in our marriage relationships and beyond. May God bless us. Let's pray. And Father, we thank you that you have given us practical advice how we should practically live out your word. And it's all about you. It's about representing you here in this world. To be this kind of mirror that shows your character and assimilates your character so that we can show it to others. Father, I want to pray today for our marriage relationships, that we never take them for granted, that we continually start working on ourselves so that our marriages can flourish, that our marriages can be the base of good families, that our relationships with our children and grandchildren or great-grandchildren and however far our family goes, that we live this kind of life that truly reflects you, where others can see what it looks like to be a follower of Jesus Christ. Give us grace. Help us to be very vulnerable in those relationships. not to put up a mask, not to put up a show, but to live our lives honestly before you. So that you can look down on us and have favor in us. That's what we look for. That's what we strive for. This is what we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.